Belgic Confession 34, Holy Baptism. We believe and confess that Jesus Christ, who is the end of the law, hath made an end by the shedding of his blood of all other sheddings of blood which men could or would make as a propitiation or satisfaction for sin. And that he, having abolished circumcision, which was done with blood, hath instituted the sacrament of baptism instead thereof, by which we are received into the church of God and separated from all other people and strange religions, that we may belong wholly to him whose ensign and banner we bear, and which serves as a testimony to us that he will forever be our gracious God and Father. Therefore, he has commanded all those who are his to be baptized with pure water in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Ghost, thereby signifying to us that, as water washeth away the filth of the body when poured upon it, and is seen on the body of the baptized when sprinkled upon him, so doth the blood of Christ, by the power of the Holy Ghost, internally sprinkle the soul, cleanse it from its sins, and regenerate us from children of wrath unto children of God. Not that this is effected by the external water, but by the sprinkling of the precious blood of the Son of God, who is our Red Sea, through which we must pass to escape the tyranny of Pharaoh, that is, the devil, and to enter into the spiritual land of Canaan. Therefore the ministers, on their part, administer the sacrament, and that which is visible. But our Lord giveth that which is signified by the sacrament, namely, the gifts and invisible grace, washing, cleansing, and purging our souls of all filth and unrighteousness, renewing our hearts and filling them with all comfort, giving unto us a true assurance of his fatherly goodness, putting on us the new man, and putting off the old man with all his deeds. Therefore we believe that every man who is earnestly studious of obtaining life eternal ought to be but once baptized with this only baptism, without ever repeating the same, since we cannot be born twice. Neither doth this baptism avail us only at the time when the water is poured upon us and received by us, but also through the whole course of our life. Therefore, we detest the error of the Anabaptists, who are not content with the one only baptism they have once received, and moreover condemn the baptism of the infants of believers, who we believe ought to be baptized and sealed with the sign of the covenant, as the children of Israel formerly were circumcised upon the same promises which are made unto our children. And indeed Christ shed his blood no less for the washing of the children of the faithful than for adult persons. And therefore they ought to receive the sign and sacrament of that which Christ hath done for them, as the Lord commanded in the law that they should be made partakers of the sacrament of Christ's suffering and death shortly after they were born, by offering for them a lamb, which was a sacrament of Jesus Christ. Moreover, what circumcision was to the Jews, that baptism is to our children. And for this reason, Paul calls baptism the circumcision of Christ. Tonight is our fourth class on Belgic Confession 34 on Holy Baptism. The title of our three classes so far have been: 1. The importance and beginning of this article. 2. God's fatherhood and the baptismal formula. And 3. The administrators of baptism. Tonight, our title is What Constitutes a Valid Baptism? And that's enough to keep us going the full 45 minutes or hour, as we will see. What constitutes a valid baptism? We're not talking here about a baptism that is necessarily a means of grace. By a valid baptism, we mean that it does not need to be performed in future. So if someone has been baptized validly, that counts as a baptism. And if they were joining, let's say, our church, we wouldn't require them to be baptized. A valid baptism. So there are three sorts of baptism then. The first is a non-valid baptism. It isn't really a baptism at all. The person claims to be baptized, or some group baptizes them, but they haven't really been baptized. Then there's a valid baptism that isn't a means of grace, but at least the baptism doesn't have to be done again. And then there's a valid baptism that is also a means of grace. A baptism in a faithful church. Not only does the person not have to be baptized, because that first baptism counts, but baptism was a means of grace to him or her, assuming the person baptized to be an elect child of God. Everybody clear? There's a non-valid baptism, you weren't really baptized. There's a valid baptism, you were baptized, but it was in a very weak church and it wasn't a means of grace. And there's a valid baptism, it's also a means of grace in a true church. Now, when we say a valid baptism, you can also have a valid baptism, just to be really clear here, if there's sin involved. There could be a whole host of sin in the baptismal ceremony. The administrator of baptism, there could be a whole host of sin in him. The one being baptized may not, shouldn't maybe be baptized at all. But that isn't the point. And the church in which the person is baptized, there could be all sorts of sin involved there too. And it could even be, let's say a baptism that's valid, it could even be a sin for anybody to be present at and endorse such a baptism. But it could still be valid. Valid simply means that basic criteria were fulfilled and it is a baptism, so that it doesn't have to be done again. That's what we mean by valid baptism. Let's look at the history of this issue. A couple of highlights over the last 2,000 years. The big issue regarding the validity of a baptism in the early church was with what group?
Donatists.
The Donatists. The Donatists in the early church were confined to which continent?
Africa.
Africa, yes. They were in Africa, and they started in what century?
Fourth.
The fourth century, and they went to the sixth century, and possibly a few remnants a bit longer, and then the religion of peace just about wiped them out in North Africa. The Donatists, so-called religion of peace, the Donatists were named after what man?
Donatus.
Donatus, yes. He wasn't the originator of the Donatists, but he was the main guy after the Donatists were started, and they were named after him. The issue that started the Donatists was the issue of traditors. And a traditor is somebody who hands something over. Can you think of any words in English that sound a bit like or look a bit like a traditor?
Tradition.
Tradition is handing over something or handing it down. What was the other word? Traitor actually comes from that too, because a traitor hands over his country or his friends. So a traditor is somebody who hands over something. Little bit of historical background here. The Roman emperor at this stage was Diocletian. Diocletian persecuted the church, and in the persecution of the church in North Africa, there were these traditors who would hand over, when under pressure, the sacred scriptures to be destroyed. Or they would hand over ecclesiastical objects like the chalice of the Lord's Supper. Or they would hand over to the authorities the names or persons of other Christians. Traditors. Handing over Bibles, chalices and other things, and Christians under pressure. But when Diocletian died and the persecution waned, many of the traditors, especially now the traditors, the handers over of scripture or church chalices, let's say, or Christians, confessed their sins when the pressure was off. And then they continued in church office, or remained their church office, or maybe a guy was a traditor, a member of the church, and then a few years later he became a deacon or a minister or a bishop or whatever. And then a lot of people in the church thought, are these people worthy? Persecution came, they compromised? Are they worthy to enter office, or especially are they worthy to remain in office? And then what about these compromised Christians? What about any ordination which they performed, if they were bishops, let's say? Or, our focus tonight, what about their baptisms? If you have a guy and he compromised, he was a traditor, and then he baptized somebody after he apologized, is that baptism valid? And the Donatists, as they came to be known, said that traditors, people who compromised in times of persecution, their baptisms are invalid. They were unworthy baptizers. And increasingly, people had to take a position on this. Increasingly, and as time went on, what about the baptisms of the church that tolerates these traditors who are baptizing? So not just such and such and such and such, his baptisms don't count, but the whole church which doesn't put him under discipline, then their baptisms are invalid too. So the Donatists would say the baptisms performed by the Catholic Church, basically the Church of the West at that time, are not valid, none of them. And if anybody then, if these two groups now, and the Donatists are worshipping separately with their own church services and own office bearers and own sacraments, if anybody leaves the Catholic Church and joins the Donatist group, they have to be rebaptized. Or rather, they have to be baptized in the first place because their baptism wasn't valid. So the issue of the church division here was moral, not doctrinal. As far as the creeds and doctrines of the Catholics and the Donatists went, they were basically the same. The issue is the traditor is unworthy to baptize. The church of the traditors is a compromised church. That whole church isn't worthy to baptize. So their baptisms are invalid, and if they join us, they have to be baptized. And Marco was so good for other reasons on the subject of the Donatists, because he knows well the number one opponent of the Donatists, namely Augustine. Right, the next group, the Donatists in the early church, coming to the Reformation, which group are we talking about now?
Anabaptists.
The Anabaptists. Yeah. So, the Donatists, continent we're thinking of here, Africa, Anabaptists, we move 1,000 years forward and we come to Europe. The number one issue with the Anabaptists, after which they are named, is their idea that infant or covenant baptism is unbiblical and the chief mark of Antichrist. But then, as a secondary issue, like the Donatists, and this is our focus now, like the Donatists, for the Anabaptists, if you were an adult who was baptized, now there weren't many adults baptized in the 1500s, but let's say a converted Muslim, let's say there's a Muslim and he gets baptized, for an Anabaptist, if that Muslim got baptized in the Roman Catholic Church, the baptism is invalid. For the Anabaptist, if that adult Muslim got baptized in a Lutheran church, the baptism is invalid. If that adult Muslim got baptized in a Reformed church, it's invalid. Why? Because all of those churches, according to the Anabaptists, are corrupt, and the ministers are corrupt too, and they do not have baptism. And then we come to the most famous example of this sort of issue in the post-Reformation church. We move from the continent of Africa with the Donatists, Europe with the Anabaptists, to the continent of America, where the issue was the validity of Roman Catholic baptism. And for Reformation people, this is the big issue, Roman Catholic baptism. I'm referring to a very famous debate in the mid-19th century America among Presbyterians. Two weighty American Presbyterians, one on each side. Does anyone know the names of the main combatants?
Hodge.
Hodge, yes. Hodge versus Charles Hodge versus Thornwell. Charles Hodge versus James Henley Thornwell. And Charles Hodge was a Princeton theologian, so he is in the north, and James Henley Thornwell is a good son of the south. He was a good son of the south too. He was a real southerner. Now, which of those two men, if you know anything of their theology or ecclesiology, which of those two men held that Roman Catholic baptism was valid and which one held it was invalid?
I'd say Hodge for valid and Thornwell against.
Yes. Hodge said Roman Catholic baptism is valid. And anybody who knows Hodge and his way of thinking would say, yeah, would have gotten at him. So Hodge said it's valid. It's valid. A converted Roman Catholic would not have to be baptized to become an American Presbyterian. And Thornwell said Roman Catholic baptism is invalid. These people haven't really been baptized at all. If they come to Jesus Christ, they must be baptized. And the position of Thornwell became the position of the Presbyterian General Assembly, old school, which met at Cincinnati in May 1845. What state is Cincinnati in?
Ohio.
Ohio. Very good, Hillary. Ohio. So that became the official position of the Presbyterian General Assembly, old school. The majority went with Thornwell's position. And then there was a minority report along the lines of Hodge, but it didn't win the day. And to this day, in Southern Presbyterianism, and now tying it to a specific denomination, this has become probably the majority view following Thornwell and that decision of 1845, so that in the Presbyterian Church in America, the PCA, which was formed, I believe, in 1973, this is their official position too. And they made a decision upon this in 1987. So any Roman Catholic who comes to Jesus Christ must be baptized to join a PCA. And this is also the position of John Robbins, brother in the States who's gone to be with the Lord, and the Trinity Review. So when the Trinity Review deals with baptism or the issues of validity of baptism, it'll take the Thornwellian position. And speaking about Thornwell, the British Reformed Fellowship, the good old BRF, has a connection to all this. Tony Horn, known personally to many in this room, a stalwart in the British Reformed Fellowship, now with the Lord, was the editor of The Presbyterian. And The Presbyterian, in the noble lineage of the British Reformed Journal, The Presbyterian was the sort of predecessor. And Tony Horn, he was the editor of The Presbyterian, and then it was replaced by the British Reformed Journal. Well, the 1992 edition, or a 1992 issue of The Presbyterian, carried Francis Nigel Lee, you remember him, Ivan? Carried Francis Nigel Lee's book review of an 87-page abridgment of Thornwell's 1846 130-page monograph. So Tony Horn asked Francis Nigel Lee, would you review this for The Presbyterian? And which way did Francis Nigel Lee and the Presbyterian go? With Hodge or Thornwell? They went with Hodge. They went with Hodge. I even said Hodge. Now, this issue about the validity of Roman Catholic baptism in the history of the PRC, and this is a harder question, has come up in terms of its synods. Anybody from your knowledge of the PRC know where the validity of Roman Catholic baptism came up? It came up in relationship to the Evangelical Reformed Churches of Singapore. And it's in the 1988 Acts of Synod, because the Evangelical Reformed Churches in Singapore had people, especially one person who wanted to become a member of the church of this person. I think that was a man, and he was a Roman Catholic. So this is a fairly young church coming out of more evangelical type of background, and you know, they're thinking to themselves, but the Roman church is a false church. We need to baptize these people. And the Protestant Reformed Synod explained to them the theological and reformed position, and the Singaporeans came to agree with that. Then there was another issue regarding the validity of baptism, not now with the Roman Catholic Church, but an issue that came up in the PRC in terms of its mission work and contacts with people in other parts of the world. More recently, in 2006, that's a clue, regarding the Philippines, because the what's now the Protestant Reformed Churches in the Philippines started with a group of people who came out of the Worldwide Church of God, which was an anti-Trinitarian cult. And then there were big convulsions in that movement. And then a number of people, including these people, had to rethink, went on the line, saw the PRCA website. And so then when that church was going, then the question was, what do we do with our baptisms? Because some of our number were baptized in the Worldwide Church of God.
Armstrongism,
which was anti-Trinitarian.
The plain truth.
Do our baptisms count? And the Protestant Reformed Church said, no, you have not been properly baptized. You must be baptized. And then there was an interesting other one. There was one person who came, whose name was brought to the synod as they were asking for advice, who had been baptized after the Worldwide Church of God packed in its anti-Trinitarianism and became Trinitarian. So what about her? And then the question was, were they fully Trinitarian, and what was going on at this stage? And actually the synod said with regard to her, it wasn't clear that they'd fully gotten rid of the anti-Trinitarianism stuff at this stage, so that the synod said she wasn't baptized either. But that one, you actually could probably debate that one a bit more. I mean, it'd be easier to debate the other side, because the first situation was pretty cut and dry. Phil?
I have a question. Maybe sounds like a very simple question, but I think it's one of
they're usually the best ones.
Like the answer, see the person themselves. See if there's an incorrect judgment made by the church that they're going to join. Say they have been baptized, and say someone has taken Thornwell's position,
mm-hmm.
and they get rebaptized. The person themselves, that doesn't have any detrimental effect upon them in relation to their spiritual well-being, their salvation, their walk with Christ, because really, I mean, the people who are insisting upon them being rebaptized, if that person is in ignorance and just goes along with it,
uh-huh.
if you're baptized twice or three or four times, you know, someday if you come to the realization that it wasn't necessary, it really isn't a big issue. Is it for the person?
No, it's not the biggest issue, and I think Luther and others referred to similar things, said, well, God is merciful, and with bigger sins that need forgiving than that one. So yes, and if you're going to talk about who did the worst thing there, it would actually be the church more than the person who was rebaptized, because mm-hmm. in reality we believe that the first baptism was that which counted. Yes. Now the CPRC has had to deal with this issue. Someone comes in as a member, and the issue is, has this person been baptized? Some former Roman Catholics have come to the church, and there have been other more complicated situations. So it can be tricky, because there's general principles, you see. This is just by the side. There's general principles, and then there's sometimes, what are you doing? That one sort of falls outside the general principles. And then there's also the issue about the historical facts, because they can be hard to obtain. Was this a church or not? Was the guy who ordained you a minister or not? And then, well, he sort of is, and so it can be more tricky. So this issue about the validity of baptism might sound a strange one, but the Presbyterian has had to deal with it. The BRJ, the CPRC has had to deal with it. Our sister churches, the PRC in Singapore and their sister church soon to be in the Philippines, the reformers have had to take a position on it, and the vast majority of historic Protestantism has had to think through it at some stage. And all those parties that I've mentioned believe that Roman Catholic baptism is valid, though not a means of grace. Which brings us to the three requirements for a valid baptism. And I need to be sure that you've all got the distinction in your mind what a valid baptism is. The three requirements for a valid baptism are set forth in the Reformed Creeds, and it's especially clear in Westminster Confession 28:2. Quote, "The outward element to be used in the sacrament is water, wherewith the party to be baptized is to be baptized in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Ghost, by a minister of the gospel lawfully called." So number one here, we have the element, the outward element, water. Number two, we have the formula, Trinitarian. And number three, we have the administrator, the minister. So the element of baptism, with what is the person to be baptized?
Water.
The form or formula of baptism, with what words is the person to be baptized? The administrator of baptism, by whom is the person to be baptized? Can you identify these three things, not as clearly marked as such though, can you identify these three things in Belgic Confession 34? The element of water.
Pure water.
Especially what paragraph?
Second paragraph.
Paragraph 2. The formula, Trinitarian. Paragraph 2 again. The administrator being the minister. Which paragraph?
3.
Paragraph 3. Now, Rome has three requirements for a valid baptism too. Because Rome has to come up with this. What's a valid baptism? And actually they not only have three requirements, but they also use the word valid. Because from their point of view, they face this too. Someone joins the Roman Church, do they need to be baptized? That is, how, if they have a, some sort of water, whatever's happened, whatever rite or ceremony, was that a valid one? Was that recognized by them? Rome says that the matter, or we'll stick with our terminology, the element, it must be the proper element. It must be water. Rome agrees. The proper form or formula must be Trinitarian.
Do they make the water into holy water before they use it?
They do make it into holy water, but it's still water. And then with regard to the third thing, instead of talking about the administrator, Rome talks about the proper intention. So the third factor is changed. Not the administrator, but the intention. And then with the issue of intention, they mean by that not only the intention of the minister has to have the right intention, namely to baptize, and the recipient must have the right intention, namely, as a bare minimum, to be baptized, or if it's an infant being baptized, the parents or godparents of the recipient infant must have the proper intention, namely to have his or him or her baptized. So for Rome, for a baptism to be valid, the element must be water, the formula must be Trinitarian, and the intention of the baptizer and the baptized one, or the substitutes for the baptized one, must be proper, either to baptize or to be baptized. But for us as Reformed Protestants, the proper intention.
How do you know? Like mind reading or something.
Mind reading is incredibly subjective. You could imagine spending the last few hours with a priest, who baptized you, and the guy then tells you just before you, oh, by the way, I didn't have an intention to baptize you. And that really matters, because Because baptism, I mean, you need to be baptized to be saved. It's necessary for justification within the Roman system. And you see, this instance of intention crops up again because it's part of Roman Catholic sacramental theory. The ex operato. It works automatically, mechanically almost, you could say, as long as there's no barrier put up, and you're not in mortal sin, or as long as you're intending what it is, because they have to bring in a wee bit of subjectivity. Otherwise, it's just completely mechanical. But then they bring in the wrong sort of subjectivity, and impossible to assess subjectivity for the baptism. Now, there are also some Protestants, especially those who oppose Roman Catholic baptism as valid, who speak of design or intent. And when they spell out the three aspects that make up a valid baptism, yeah, element, formula, and then instead of saying administrator, they use the language and ideas of Rome and talk about design or intention. But that isn't what Westminster 28:2 talks about when it talks about the minister lawfully called. And it isn't what Belgic Confession 34 talks about. The minister administers the sacrament. It doesn't bring up the issue of intention or design. And then we have problems with this, not only as not being what the confessions are talking about, but as being subjective again. And then how do you assess that? Marco?
What are briefly the main points that Tornival offers in order to reject the validity of the Roman Catholic baptism?
Thornwell has all sorts of arguments, but the main argument was your question. The main argument is Rome's a false church. Its ministers are false teachers. Its theology is a false doctrine. It preaches a false gospel. There can be no valid sacraments in that system. That's Thornwell's position in a nutshell.
But as a confession of Presbyterian, will they judge, for example, consistent Armenian church as heretical too, a false church?
I don't know actually if Thornwell deals with that, but you're bringing up the issue to, let's not just apply this to Rome.
Yeah.
What's your judgment of all these other churches, and then how can you apply the standard? I think what Marco's doing here is he's thinking through consequences of this.
Yeah.
And you're dead right to do that.
You understand though why it's Rome specifically that they're thinking about, given when they lived in Presbyterianism, was always seen their struggle as being against the Roman Catholic Church, so they kind of concentrated now and really for long and on.
I agree with your point there, Philip, but there's also a little bit historically anomalous that the Presbyterian Church, it's in the 19th century, in the middle of the 19th century, and the Presbyterian Church in America, and the Presbyterians in America traditionally weren't as strong against Roman Catholicism. Americans typically aren't. And then the strange thing is that the Presbyterian Church in America changed the Westminster Confession. They didn't like the bit where it says that the Pope is the Antichrist. So here are these Presbyterians who say that the Pope isn't the Antichrist, but his baptisms are invalid, whereas the historic Presbyterian position would have been, you know, he is the Antichrist, but his baptism is valid. I mean, if you looked at those two factors together, you would have thought it would have been those who believe that the Pope is the Antichrist, his baptisms are not valid. Or if somebody changed it to make Rome not the Antichrist, then they could maybe say, therefore his baptism is valid. And I don't believe actually the Pope is the Antichrist either. But that's not because I've softened my views of Rome, but that's because what the Bible says about the papacy, or what the Bible says about the Antichrist, the papacy doesn't fulfill all of those. There's more developments of sin and wickedness to come. So let's go through in more detail the three requirements to Roman Catholic baptism. The element is water. Now, Rome adds things to the rite. These are the things mentioned in the Catechism of the Catholic Church, CCC. There's chrism, perfumed oil. There's the sign of the cross. There's exorcism. There's the candle, and there's the white garment. The white garment. But for all that, the baptizing element is the water. And then they also, as Philip says, they make it into some sort of holy water. But holy water is just as wet and just as H2O as unholy water. The formula is Trinitarian. There's no doubt they use the exact same words as we do from Matthew 28 verse 19 at that key point. The formula is Trinitarian. Now Rome, her doctrine of Mariolatry, the idolatrous veneration of the Virgin Mary, and her prayers to saints and the veneration of idols and all the other false doctrines, including justification by faith, corrupt the truth of the Trinity. But the requirement for a valid baptism isn't, does everything that this church teach fit with the Trinity? It's, does it use the right formula and mean by it basic Christian ideas? And it does. The administrator, because we're not now talking about that intention, that's not going the right way. The third factor is the administrator of the baptism. And now here we need to distinguish, because we do believe in the validity of Roman Catholic baptism. But there is a wrinkle here with regard to the administrator, because we believe the Roman Catholic baptism is valid if a bishop does it, or if a priest does it, but not if a deacon does it. Because for Rome, that's not just a valid baptism if they do it. That is a means of grace. They would accept that. But we don't accept it, even as a valid baptism, if a deacon does it. And as for emergency baptism performed by a midwife, so we say we accept Roman Catholic baptism, but we don't accept the midwife doing a baptism, or the shopkeeper, who we mentioned last week, who shot the robber and then got a bottle of water, opened up his bottle of water. We wouldn't accept that.
Look, does that not present a problem, though, if someone came to join the church and they were for a Roman Catholic, and you said to them, have you been baptized? Obviously, yes, I have. Who baptized you? Well, it was the bishop. And you admit them as a member, and then, you know, it turns out that it wasn't the bishop. They got that wrong. So, in fact, they're not baptized. It was actually a deacon.
Uh-huh. But then you would have to have to ask the right question, probe a little bit.
How would they ever, you know, is there a way in which
there are baptismal forms. The Church of Rome keeps records, but sometimes records can be destroyed.
Yeah.
And all sorts of things can come. If a person misremembered, let's say, and said he was baptized by a bishop or a priest, and he didn't, and he wasn't, well, the church baptized the person on that grounds. The church is totally blameless. Now, if the person did that simply because they forgot or whatever, or their mother told them that, or their mother made a mistake, I don't think that's, I mean, the Lord has a whole lot of really big sins in us to deal with in us. So we accept Roman Catholic baptism if it's done by a bishop or a priest, but not a deacon or a midwife or that shopkeeper we spoke of earlier. So we accept Roman Catholic baptism depending on who baptized them in terms of their office. This goes back to what Marco asked about earlier, but we're going to come at it from a slightly different angle. It is our position that the criticisms of Rome made by people in the Thornwell or PCA tradition are irrelevant as regards the validity of Rome's baptism. Listen very carefully to this sentence. We believe that the criticisms of Rome by Thornwell and others in that tradition, we believe that they are valid criticisms of Rome, but not valid arguments against the validity of Rome's baptism. We believe that Thornwell's criticisms of Rome are valid criticisms, but they're not valid arguments against the validity of Rome's baptism. Anybody want to say that back to me? They're valid criticisms of Rome, but not valid arguments against the validity of Rome's baptism. For instance, when people of the Thornwell stream say that there are all sorts of wrong, false, and heretical things at the baptismal service itself, that they have extraneous and superstitious rites mixed in with, that the liturgy is not solidly biblical, that the baptismal doctrine, like baptismal regeneration, the necessity of baptism for salvation, is completely false. The sermon could have been as heretical as all get out, although most Roman Catholic sermons are so vapid that there isn't actually anything in them that's per se heretical most of the time. It's just the sort of humanistic garbage you could get on a TV program. And then we go further and we say, with Thornwell and the others, yeah, look at those false doctrines. Tell you what, I could add a few more. Look, it's a false gospel. It sure is. The church is stuffed full of false teachers, probably to a man. It is a false church. We agree with you. Your biblical and theological criticisms are correct. And as I said, we could probably throw some more, and we could even get fired up about it and start waving our fists. But with regard to the validity of baptism, these are very important criticisms of the Church of Rome, but as regards the validity of baptism, they are actually irrelevant.
You'll probably deal with this, I'm sure you will, but I know we're going to deal with the Lord's Supper in the next article. Could someone raise that objection? You will accept the baptism of the Roman Catholic Church. How then do you reject the Mass and say there's no validity in that whatsoever?
That's a good point to raise, and the answer to that one's simple. The baptism is a once and for all thing. You don't repeat it. Whereas the nature of the Lord's Supper is that you do repeat it. So if someone has been validly baptized, they don't need to be baptized again. But if someone comes out of Romanism where they have the Mass, well, they're going to confess that idolatry and forsake that, then they're going to take the Lord's Supper properly.
Would you ever say that there was any validity in that sacrament for them when they were in the Roman Catholic?
But the issue of validity doesn't really crop up with the Lord's Supper, because validity is, addresses the issue, hasn't been done such that it doesn't need to be done again. But since baptism is a once and for all initiatory, and the Lord's Supper isn't, it doesn't crop up.
Yeah. But also the Roman Catholic baptism meets those three criteria, while the Roman Catholic Lord's Supper doesn't meet really any biblical criteria, because the theology is wrong, the administration is wrong. Probably only the administrator is right, because...
Yes. But with regard, you see, to even the Lord's Supper, there aren't any three criteria for, or any number of criteria, for its being validity, because for its being valid or not, because the issue of validity isn't there at all. So I want to make things crystal clear, and here's as sharp as I can make it. If someone in this room, who's not an office bearer, make it really clear, Tommy, I hope you don't mind if I refer to you, because I don't think you'll get annoyed. If you, as a member of the CPRC in good standing and orthodox, if you baptize someone with water, factor number one, using the Trinitarian formula, that baptism would be invalid, that wouldn't count, that person would have to be baptized. But if the Pope of Rome baptize someone with water using the Trinitarian formula, his baptism would be valid and yours wouldn't.
Trumped by the Pope.
But you were going to heaven though, and he'd be going to hell. But on this issue about validity, see, it's objective standards. So we you know, because sometimes we'll say, would you accept somebody who was baptized by the Pope? Yes. Because they're trying to beat you down for your position. Yes, we would. So what we do then, when someone wants to join the CPRC, as it happened several times, and we hope it will happen many more times, and agrees with the person doctrinally, that is, they agree with the church doctrinally, they can answer the three questions: to believe the doctrines taught here to be the true and complete doctrine of salvation, yes, you resolve to believe new and godly life, yes, are you going to submit to church government, and if you should be delinquent, which God graciously forbid church discipline, yes. Well, if the person has a no baptism, if the person has been baptized earlier validly, including by a bishop or a priest in the Church of Rome, we will not baptize them. Because that would be anabaptism, which is forbidden in Belgic Confession 34, paragraphs 4 and 5. And then we would say, well, but did you not baptize this person? Well, the person has been, they've been validly baptized. But then we would add to this the Reformation and Presbyterian doctrine of improving one's baptism. This is Westminster Larger Catechism, question and answer 167. It's an old-fashioned term, improving your baptism. It means getting more out of that baptism, not actually making the baptism itself better. Question 167. How is our baptism improved by us? The needful but much neglected duty of improving our baptism, whether you have a Roman Catholic baptism or even us here today, the needful but much neglected duty of improving our baptism is to be performed by us all our life long, especially in the time of temptation, think Luther, and when we are present at the administration of it to others, as happens in our church. By serious and thankful consideration of the nature of it and of the ends for which Christ hath instituted it, the privileges and benefits conferred and sealed thereby, and our solemn vow made therein, by being humbled for our sinful defilement, our falling short of and walking contrary to the grace of baptism and our engagements, by growing up to assurance of pardon of sin, and of all other blessings sealed to us in that sacrament, by drawing strength from the death and resurrection of Christ, into whom we are baptized for the mortifying of sin and quickening of grace, and endeavouring to live by faith, to have our conversation in holiness and righteousness, as those who have given themselves up to Christ, and to walk in brotherly love as being baptized by the same Spirit into one body. That's lengthy. But here's what it comes down to. Roman Catholic joins the church, believes in Jesus, we don't baptize him, and we tell him, you have been baptized, validly. Element of water, formerly the Trinitarian, the administrator, he may have been the biggest heretic, even by Rome's rating, because not even their orthodoxy is held by many of their own priests. But you have been baptized, and what you are to do is think, the essence of baptism was there, God works the grace of that baptism now as I, believing in Jesus Christ, recall what was in effect a valid baptism, and now that baptism, by the grace of the Spirit, comes to me, as it were, as a means of grace. That is, God uses that as I think about that. And I have been as validly baptized as anyone else, and now as I approach that by faith, I can derive the benefits from it. As Martin Luther, for instance, was baptized under the papacy, and he improved his baptism quite a lot.
All the reformers, basically.
All the reformers. Now, three simple arguments explaining the strength of our position. Number one, the creedal argument. Westminster 28:2, already quoted. These are the three things you need. That's it. Just those three things. Don't bring in a fourth thing or a fifth thing or a 17th thing. Just the three. So the creedal argument. Secondly, we have the historical argument. And Martin Luther, in his book concerning rebaptism, makes a lot of this. Ours is the majority position that Rome's baptism is valid, and that with those three things, proper element, proper formula, ordained administrator, this is the majority position regarding the validity of baptism for two millennia. All the reformers held our view. None of them were rebaptized. And Luther, in his book on concerning rebaptism, raises the question, before the Reformation, I mean, if you Anabaptists are right, before the Reformation, was there a single person truly baptized in the whole of Latin Christendom? Not a single one. Nobody baptized whatsoever, according to your view. And given their view, the Anabaptists held a sort of restorationist view, a bit like the cult, that there was nothing until they came along. There'd be nobody properly baptized for centuries. Wow. And then, adding to this historical argument, we are in the right stream. We don't have a majority, that counts for something. but not always is that the decisive factor. It's far better actually to be in the right stream than to have the majority. We're in the right stream in terms of the Donatist debate in the early church. The Donatists were wrong. They were separatists and rigorists. And they died out. We're in the right stream with the Reformation against the Anabaptists. And we are also in the right stream with historic Presbyterianism versus Thornwell. Thornwell had some great strengths. He taught the spirituality of the church very well too. He opposed church boardocracy and extolled the office of elder. He has many fine things to say about sovereign grace, including some good exegesis of key texts which are used by some as if they taught that God loves everybody and wants to save everybody. But on the sacrament of baptism, it wasn't his forte. He didn't write that much about it, probably just as well. But he also had the unreformed view of the children of believers. He believed in pedobaptism, good, but he didn't have the reformed view of the children of believers. His position was more similar to Jonathan Edwards, that the children of children of believers, Jonathan Edwards said, are to be viewed as little vipers. Well, Thornwell said the children of believers are to be viewed as enemies of Christ. That's not the Reformation teaching. That's not the Heidelberg Catechism. That's not Calvin. It's not any of them. And you see, that's basically the Baptist view. He has the Baptist view of children, but he still has pedobaptism.
Did he teach that to his children?
Well, I don't know what he taught to his children, because it was the article I was reading by Francis Nigel Lee, in which he mentions it, and I thought to myself, I'd really like to see in what context or in what way. He put it in inverted commas. He said that he viewed the children of believers as, quote, the enemies of Christ, close quote. The third argument, the creedal argument, the historical argument, and the third argument is what I'm calling the objectivity argument. The people who hold the Thornwellian position, and Mark was getting at this earlier, they need to tell us what they think about other churches and their baptisms. Okay, so you say Rome's is invalid. What about Eastern Orthodoxy? It's going to have to be invalid too. What about Lutheranism? When there's baptismal regeneration there. What about Anglicanism? Huge swathes of Anglicanism are corrupt. And with the Tractarian and other influences, their baptismal regeneration as well. The Church of Ireland, does that baptism count?
Many Baptist churches do, where baptism is basically just like a public confessional faith. It has no real... It's no real means of grace at all in some Baptist churches.
Yes, it's not a means of grace, just an ordinance that helps to stir up your memory.
It's a public testimony that
You're a Christian.
Yeah, that you're a Christian.
Okay. I was going to ask you, but you know, talking about the valid baptisms, we touched on this last week. What about in baptistic churches then, where it's not the pastor who baptizes, but say it's an elder baptizes?
What about an elder baptism? We're actually going to come back to that if we get time. We're getting near the end. We'll hold that thought for a minute. What about an Arminian church, right, where they hate all the doctrines of grace? What about a charismatic church? I mean, where do you draw the line here? And it was difficult enough in the 1840s than America. It's an awful lot harder today.
That's the key thing there. Just the 1-2-3.
The 1-2-3. The objective. Keep it objective. And then you see, there's the question about, what about all these other churches? And then there's the issue about, we're talking about the soundness. Are we talking about the soundness of the denomination? Or are we talking about the soundness of the congregation? Or are we talking about the soundness of the office bearers? Or the soundness of the minister? Or the soundness of the preaching of the minister? Sometimes there are ministers who are more sound than their preaching. Although that's a sad testimony itself. They know they couldn't... They actually believe a lot of things in their study, if you can accept them at their word, but they don't preach it, because they get scalped for it. So what is it? And then the question is, how do you assess that? The denomination, the congregation, the minister, the preaching... Maybe the minister became more orthodox or less orthodox over time. Who knows?
You end up in no valid baptism in any church.
No valid baptism. Then how far back? Let's say you've got somebody and he was baptized 10 years ago in such and such a church. Well, what was that church like 10 years ago when he was baptized? What was the denomination like? Oh, but the office bearers in that congregation, what sort of things was the minister preaching? Okay, let's go back 20 years ago. Or let's say the guy was baptized in Malawi or China or India or France or Brazil. And how in the wide world is the consistory going to assess all this? Or 20 years back, or 30 years back, or 40 years back, or 50 years back, or 60 years back, or 70. And then you see, once you make a decision about all these churches, and then which, the denomination, the congregation, the minister, whatever, and all these years, I mean, you need encyclopedic knowledge. And then how are you going to be consistent? Are you going to be consistent? Well, you do this for this one who came in from an Anglican church 30 years ago, and that we reckoned that one was probably valid. And this one came from a Arminian church, they were baptized 50 years ago. And this one came in from a holiness church. And then how are you going to be consistent in a denomination? It's going to be a mess. Then is the person really a member in the denomination? Let's conclude with some more tricky examples. Is this baptism valid? A woman minister, and it's not an emergency baptism, baptizing with water using the Trinitarian formula in a Presbyterian church. No. No, it's not. The Synod of Dort in 1574, there were more synods of Dort than the famous one, opposed it. Prof. Engelsman had an editorial about it in the Standard Bearer some years back. She cannot objectively be a minister, just as two women cannot marry, or two men cannot marry, because 1 Timothy 2, which we read earlier, and 1 Timothy 3 for that, rules it out. And by the way, Calvin points out, Institutes, Book 4, Chapter 15, Sections 20 and 21, that all women baptism was opposed by Tertullian and Epiphanius and the Council of Carthage in the early church. But Rome claims to believe and practice what was believed by everybody, always and everywhere. What about a transsexual? This may well crop up in some of our lifetimes. Let's say someone is baptized by a transsexual.
Minister.
That's the next. We're coming to that in a minute. This transsexual baptizes someone with water using a Trinitarian formula in a Protestant church.
If he's a male.
What's the gender?
If he's objectively a male, yes.
If he's objectively a male, Marco says, if he's objectively a male, but he has, quote, transitioned to a woman, baptism is valid. That's what I think, too. If the person is objectively a woman, but has transitioned to a man, no. I don't think that baptism is valid. No. And that hopefully we never see that thing, although, you know, but it could happen. There will be consistories faced with that in the days ahead. You get homosexual ministers in, you get women ministers in first, homosexuals in next, and things are speeding up. The transsexuals will be coming into the transgenders. What about if everything else is okay, the formula is used, water is used? What if a homosexual minister baptizes someone? Is that baptism, homosexual male, is that baptism valid?
Yes,
it's valid. What about an excommunicated minister with a regular call from a church?
Depends what he's excommunicated for.
Does it depend what he's excommunicated for? Let's say if we have a church and we have a minister who's excommunicated, that minister then goes off, as he typically does, gets a call to another church, and then he baptizes somebody, and then a member of that church who was baptized by him then seeks to become a member of our church. When he was ordained by the minister who was excommunicated by our church.
If he's excommunicated, is he not outside the church?
But he was validly ordained in the first place. And the Donatists and so forth, the Western Church against this, the Western Church's typical position is even an excommunicated person, if they're validly appointed by some group, but he's outside the church. But then where do you draw? You see, then there's the issue about the validity of the excommunication. Was the excommunication right? You do. And then you see if the administrator, he's lawfully ordained, what's the difference? You know, to be installed or ordained as a minister in the Roman Catholic Church practically is to be excommunicated. Here's the Babink refers to this one. Baptism by itinerant papists and Mennonites shall not be thoughtlessly repeated, but if the other things are there, it's valid. The baptism administered by an excommunicated minister shall be judged in the same way if he has a regular call from any gathering. If the guy is actually ordained in a church, it's a proper group, the Reformed position. See, it's a baptism by a heretic or a baptism by an excommunicate. It fulfills the objective, the name of the Trinity. And you see, God is working where that water, and that it's a valid thing. He has been baptized. See, somebody could be a pastor, but then not really be in a church, just doing a few things on his own. That doesn't really count either. What about someone who's an unbeliever who was baptized as an adult? He was baptized as an adult, but then he comes to realize later on he was an unbeliever. Then he's later converted.
That's
valid. Water, the name of the triune God, minister, that is valid. There's no need to do a baptism.